From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. This past Saturday, on the 26th of October, Black Agenda Report held its 13th anniversary celebration in New York City. It was the first such celebration to occur since the passing of co-founder Bruce Dixon earlier this year. Among those presenting to the group was Professor Tony Montero from Philadelphia, who discussed the present conditions facing black people in particular and the working class in general here in the United States and around the world. We discussed his presentation with him via Skype from Philadelphia Thursday. So that was quite some event in the city this past weekend, and I really enjoyed your talk on essentially getting to a point where there's a working class movement that's worthy of the working class and of the black working class in particular.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I entitled my presentation, Building a Left That's Worthy of Black People and the Working Class.
Right.
And the major thesis of it was that what is the left is pretty much self-defined, not so much in practice, but in its identity of itself, and that the left, as it is defined by itself, is neither worthy of black people or of the working class, and that going forward, we who are left must build that kind of movement. And the other thing that I was saying is that the people, black folk and the working class, you're not talking about separate categories, but you're really talking about mutually dependent, interpenetrating social categories or social groups. So to talk about black folk in many ways is to talk about the working class.
Right.
To talk about the working class is to talk about black folk.
Right.
And of course, black folk are, in terms of the working class, the most highly working class group in the country, and have been so for a couple of few hundred years. But so what does a left do? What, especially, let us say, groups like BAR, Black Agenda Report, which are an ideological collective, or groups like what we do in Philadelphia, the Saturday Free School, which again is ideological, but then has a kind of a tactic and strategy of mobilizing people for particular things. And of course, we participate in events and protests and so on. But my point is that the working class and black folk, through their actions, and even through the polls, polling data that we can trust, are calling out for, are demanding a leadership that is left, but is not yet on a national scale, and most times on a local scale, what is being demanded by working people and by black people. And so how do we, in other words, the question is, what is to be done in the face of all of this?
Right. And this is something, you know, this condition is something that you posited, at least in our conversations, back at least in 2015, which is essentially that there was already a working class uprising in place,
right,
in progress, that we saw evidence of this with the rise of Trump in the polls and then through the process in the Republican Party. The same with Sanders in the Democratic Party, at the same time that you had all this street activity over a million things, beginning with the, you know, Black Lives Matter and recently put down Wall Street, Occupy,
mm-hmm,
Wall Street movement.
Occupy,
that,
yes.
That the working class, yes, was, you know, basically making it or reflecting the fact that it was becoming impossible to govern in the old ways because it was not satisfying the needs and demands of the working class, and,
mm-hmm,
that they were sort of stumbling around in place to find a solution. And this indicated a lack of the kind of leadership that you're talking about.
That's right. And really now, with the rise for the first time in decades of a strike movement, even though the GM settled with the UAW, there are a whole lot of UAW workers that are very, very unhappy with that settlement.
Right.
But we see it in teachers' strikes, and the strike movement is going to continue, and all it will take is a serious recession to even step it up more. But you know, even separate and apart from the strike movement, you know, you just know it in everyday life that working right. people are dissatisfied. Right. They're dissatisfied with the political leadership of this country. There will probably be as many people not voting in 2020, and I'm predicting this, as do vote, certainly on local levels. I mean, in Philadelphia, they can celebrate, the establishment celebrates when 25% of registered voters even turn out to
right.
vote.
That's right.
So it is not any enthusiasm about the system as such. Now, this occurs within the framework of an impeachment process going forward. And let me just say this. It is clear that this impeachment thing is all about a new Cold War, because yeah. the way they're framing it is that Trump has sold out the nation in return for some benefits from Putin or other people.
Right.
And this sellout in the face of, quote, honest and patriotic civil servants, also you could read that CIA agents, right. deep state agents,
right.
Who are trying to save the country from Trump. So I guess what I'm saying is part of the great dissatisfaction is with this impeachment charade,
right.
but also the dissatisfaction is not just from the visuals of politicians pursuing impeachment and not lowering pharmaceutical prices or raising the minimum wage or rebuilding infrastructure. That's part of what angers people. But the other side of it, and this is a subtext, a subtle nuance of the whole thing, often or seldom mentioned, is that the people in 2016 voted for the candidate that said that he didn't want any more wars
That's
in
right.
the Middle East.
Right. That's right.
And the Democratic Party has become the party of war,
yep.
the party of a new Cold War. And in spite of everything they try to say, and it is disingenuous, about health care for all and free tuition and, you know, we're going to give you the world
right.
and whatever else you want. In spite of all that, the masses of people find most of the Democratic Party candidates disingenuous, and as they do most of the bourgeois leadership of the country.
Yep, the Republican Party as well, as a matter of fact.
Yes, that's true.
You know, it's good to look at the international context at this point, because you also have, when you're talking about the essentially the resistance to the neoliberal austerity budgets that, you know, has been building around the world, you know, contemporaneous with Trump's election and actually just slightly preceding it, we saw the Brexit, which people now admit was a response to neoliberalism, primarily by working people who were losing their jobs and you know, being impacted negatively by the EU. And we're seeing now where even 4 years ago and 5 years ago in Latin America, they were willing to gamble on Macri and on some of the claimed anyway, you know, people ran as soft right-wing governments, that not only are they voting them out, but that's being preceded by people going into the streets. As a matter of fact, that there were strikes and street actions in Argentina almost immediately after Macri took office in December of 2015, and throughout the entire term, and Macri's out after one term, and what's going on in Chile, of course, makes that look like a party.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And Haiti and Egypt.
That's right.
Lebanon. Yeah. So, oh, yeah. Yeah. It's one of those moments in history. And as you mentioned, Brexit is a response to the neoliberal global order that had, and the austerity that goes with it. And then on top of that, the Great Recession of 2008, and the fact that workers never recovered, but the banks and the rich became more rich, more wealthy.
That's right.
So, yeah, you got anger all across the globe. And you mention it. The ruling class cannot rule in the old way, and the working people are not going to be ruled in the old way. That was Lenin's formulation, and he said that defined the revolutionary situation.
Right.
And I added on Saturday at the Black Agenda Report thing, but what Lenin assumed is the existence of a revolutionary party leading a more or less united left. We don't have that today.
Right.
And that's why when you take, for example, the Democratic Socialist of America, reputedly the largest socialist organization in the country, whose major tactic and strategy is to take over the Democratic Party or to move the Democratic Party to the left. And that's a fool's project. It's not going to happen. But that's a way of saying that they, the DSA, are not capable or willing to make the sacrifice to build a people's movement. I mentioned also that the Communist Party of the United States has taken up a similar tactic and strategy. This strategy and this tactic does not recognize the time of day that we live in. Let me put it this way, we're on the cusp of a political collapse of the country. And it is a question of who will govern, who can govern. The old elites cannot govern. And we're finding that out every day. And since they can't govern, what is the alternative? Now, I have said that a great movement beginning at grassroots levels in cities and towns and neighborhoods where organic and authentic people's leaders emerge that come forward increasingly with a people's program, not yet prepared to take power, but saying that they are no longer willing to accept what is. I think that's what we're looking at right now. I think our experience in Philadelphia suggests that there's something sustainable, politically sustainable, about being connected to unions and churches and civic organizations and students' organizations. And there's something sustainable about having a political and ideological agenda of helping the masses to see a world that does not seem possible. We can do that. But I would say that the situation of what defines itself as the left is the collapse of more or less Trotskyist organizations like the International Socialist Organization and other smaller Trotskyist groups, and the pretty much collapse of the Democratic Socialist and the Communist Party by literally giving up the fight and saying that that they're going to be a part of the Democratic Party. Let me just make one other point. You know, I often think, what would Lenin say to the DSA and the Communist Party of the day? How would he respond to it? Well, he did say, I think, something that gets us close to what he may have said today, and that is in the work What Is to Be Done, where he talked about this kind of economism where all you need are the unions, The unions will be the vanguard. Without a party or movement that has a larger ideological purpose. I think the modern day or 21st century equivalent of that is that the Democratic Party, which is reputed to be a liberal party with quotes around that, will be the antidote to, quote, fascism. And again, you know, in our conversations over the years, I've made it clear that that there are as many fascists in the Democratic Party, a little more sophisticated, a little more effective in their public relations, but there's many fascists in the Democratic Party as in the Republican Party. And that fascism does not have to fight from the outside to take power, because the fascists have been in power for at least 50 years, if not a few years more than that.
Right. I mean, you know, it's a question. Were the fascists in power when they killed Kennedy already because they had the ability to do so? Or did they take power when they killed Kennedy?
Right.
You know, the one of the biggest problems that I see begins with even having conversations like this, where the vocabulary is 100 years old or more.
Yeah.
Used by people, some people deliberately, you know, in the public, first of all, the public relations effort from almost the beginning to completely distort the meaning of all of the scientific terminology that goes mm-hmm. with political science and socialism and communism and Marxism. But even now, where it's been so bastardized that even the colors of the two teams, you have two political entities of one kind or another, the Republican and Democratic parties that are, you know, electoral tribes or whatever, mm-hmm. The emblematic colors are the opposite of what the parties are supposed to symbolically represent. I mean, look, ideologically, there's not a hair's worth of difference between the two of them, as we know. But one is supposed to be left-leaning and the other right-leaning. And mm-hmm. suggesting left, you would think red is the color historically, and suggesting the nationalism or the right, blue would be the color, and those are the opposite mm-hmm. of the ones here. So from there, the terminology gets even more abusive and abused, basically. And so it's hard to even have a conversation where the terminology is uncertain.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, that is why I think that we have a lot of work to do ideologically and politically to define what we mean and who we are. And see, that is the big problem with so many of the groups on the so-called left. They have abandoned this this work of defining who is who and what is what. Clearly, when we talk of the two parties, we cannot speak of them today outside of the great and deepening political crisis, unprecedented perhaps in this country. And the big question for the ruling class is, can they govern? Are they capable of governing? And can they govern when the people do not see them as legitimate governors or rulers of the country? Right. And if they can't do it by democratic means, how do they do it? One of the things that I, and I think you agree with me, that from November 2016 up till today, there has been in place a coup, a moving, slow-moving coup, almost death by a thousand cuts, to overturn the 2016 election.
Yep.
You don't have to be a follower of Trump to understand that. And the question is why. The reason why is because the ruling class consensus was overturn the government of Ukraine in 2014, a overturn that was led and spearheaded by open Nazis as a stage towards overthrowing the government of Russia. That was their strategic objective.
Yep.
Trump said the opposite. He not only said the opposite about Russia, he said the opposite about the endless wars in the Middle East. That's and he right. said the opposite about the Korean Peninsula. I mean, what do you need? You connect the dots. The dots are not that difficult to connect.
Right.
But if you are ideologically unclear or ideologically afraid or a coward ideologically, there are certain inconvenient truths, certain things that you are not prepared to acknowledge or think or talk about.
And we got to remember a lot of things. First is, you know, we're talking about strategy here, essentially in war conditions. I mean, we're talking about military strategy, whether it's with guns or ideas and bodies. Yeah. Consequently, if you're working out a battle plan, which is what we're talking about, the first thing you do is assess your enemy's capabilities, you know, what they have, where it's deployed, what will neutralize it or make it ineffective, etc. Now, because of this, like, catechism approach to the history of Marxist history in particular that so many people that call themselves on the left take, you know, they're looking at the present condition as if it were Russia, the Russian Empire, the Tsar, you know, and it's 1917 or 1905, depending on which group is doing the analysis. We have a global empire that we're facing that is still successfully sucking the blood and resources of much of the planet, if not most of the planet. And that is who we stand facing on the battlefield, whether it's public relations, organizing, whatever sphere, political activity that we face them in, they are able to draw on resources unimagined by the Romanovs or by anyone else in 1917. And if we are going to fight a battle against the Romanovs, thinking that we can, you know, call people to battle in the streets of St. Petersburg, and that that's going to win the day against this behemoth, we're going to get squashed when it comes time to do that. We have to engage the enemy that exists, not the one that we want to fight. And what that means is first cutting off its ability to draw from resources around the planet, which means you have to prioritize the fight against imperialism above all else, or you lose.
I agree with that. Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, that's it, or you lose.
Yeah. In fact, methodologically, I have argued that you can't understand U.S. politics, nothing about U.S. politics, without understanding the U.S. military empire. You have to look at the United States as an empire, in a lot of ways, look at it and understand it from outside of the borders of the United States.
That's right.
You're right. And therefore, the struggle against imperialism and for peace, and I've often said, and a positive peace, a peace which also means justice for the working people. That's it. That's the key. And see, this is where you get like a anti-communist leftist, like, for example, Bernie Sanders. I mean, there's no two ways about it. Right. He made it clear when he spoke about Hugo Chavez, a dead communist dictator. I don't think he can ever escape that. But that kind of anti-communist leftism, or what you could also call pro-war leftism, or another way, social imperialism. Right. In other words, social democracy at home and imperialism and war abroad.
Right.
This betrays the working class of the United States and of the world, and is at best a fake kind of socialism. So you're right. I agree with you completely. A movement for peace, a movement for justice, a program for peace and justice, a program of demilitarization. We talk a lot about a Green New Deal, but we need multiple New Deals. And unless we connect the Green New Deal to a New Deal for working people generally, neither will be successful. So here we are. I know to us, the answer seems so apparent, so obvious. And you ask yourself, what is the problem? Why don't others get it? And, you know, and there are many answers to that question. Some, again, are quite inconvenient.
You know, there's something else, too, that come up against this a few times, and we've discussed it a little and starting to discuss it more. And that's the question of, you know, you have a Lenin and a vanguard party, quote unquote, during the revolution in 1917. Excuse me. And that party has a history of revolutionary struggle going back to 1905, preparing for this. And people that are being prepared to accept leadership based on the record of the party over a period of time. You know, we don't have any of that right now. And, you know, we have a lot of people that have been working very hard for a long time, but we have nothing like that in terms of infrastructure. And one thing that occurs to me for the first time now, after 50, 60 years of looking at this stuff, is the fact that, you know, Lenin, those people didn't have a ready-made apparatus either. Somebody involved in setting this stuff up had to become aware of the fact that, A, there was a need for it, and B, this was the path to developing it and implementing it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and that was to meet again a condition where, you know, as difficult as it might have been to go up against the Russian Empire in 1917, you know, it's kind of like trying to take over a couple of kindergartens compared to taking on the U.S. Empire with nuclear weapons and outer space tracking and all of that stuff these days. So, but this is exactly the point, that this leadership has got to come from us, from the working class. And so first we need a definition of terms. What is it that exists around us, and who are we, and what is it that we want, and agree on that in one fashion or another, agree on it, and then find a path to it and see who's got the flashlight.
That's it. That's it. And it's going to take a lot of hard work. I think it's doable because of the magnitude of the crisis, but also because the crisis is global. And you know, one of the things is that working people and people in general have more information now than they've ever had. Understanding all of this information is a whole nother thing. But people know more about the world than at any other time in history. And they can see Chile, they can see Haiti, they can see Lebanon and other places, and they can draw certain conclusions. So they're aware of a world more than just their nation. And that's a good thing. So there's already something of a predisposition to a kind of internationalism. And upon that, we can build.
Professor Montero, thank you very much. A pleasure as always. And we will catch up with you again next week.
Thank you so much, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.